copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, let me just say by way of beginning that I am not an expert in any sense of this word, but what I am is that I've been a practitioner all my Christian life. I came to faith in 1977. I was not raised in a Christian home, so I didn't have a Christian background, and coming from Scotland, which was pretty secular, in fact not pretty, very secular, Christianity was not approved and has continued to be almost in the decline in many respects. But from the beginning, I was involved in sharing both my testimony, you know, how I came to God, and then doing door-to-door witness and all kinds of things. So really, gospel communication became, you know, from day one what I did. Then I came on to Operation Mobilization, and that's what we did. Then we moved into Eastern and Central Europe. And for the next 36 years, really, in one form or another, I've been trying to understand the gospel, share it, and help people to understand it and communicate it. So that's really what this is about. So these are reflections of my thoughts, really, on mission, and I've obviously drawn in various other voices. But one of my favorite passages about the gospel is found in Titus chapter 2. Every now and again you get these summaries, and they're fantastic because they give you a real overview of the thrust of the gospel. And here it says, in a compressed sense, Titus 2:11 through 15, "For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men, instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires, and to live sensibly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior Christ Jesus, who gave himself for us to redeem us from every lawless deed and to purify for himself a people for his own possession, zealous for good deeds. These things speak and exhort and reprove with all authority. Let no one disregard you." Now, these phrases, I sometimes think that's what we need to do, just with our mind and our imagination, but to think of the implications of that. "For the grace of God appeared." So there was an actual point in space-time history when God, the living God of all reality, who's made everything, steps into human history. That's no small thing. And so for C.S. Lewis and for many others, he called this, this was the event that decided everything, called it the grand miracle in many of his writings. One writer calls it the hinge of history, because it claims to say that the Christian view of reality, obviously, is that we're in a creation, that there is a God, that everything that is that we see is designed by God and therefore has intent. So either that's a true statement or it's false. Either that is reality or it's non-reality. And that may be obvious to us, but it's not obvious to people outside in the world. In fact, they believe it's unreality. They think we are make-believers. They think that we are projecting God from our emotions or from our heritage. But if you compare this passage with some of the others I've mentioned there, John chapter 1, 1 through 5, Colossians 1, 15 through 20, and Hebrews 1 through 4, you see that the strength of this vision. Now, sometimes I think the problem for mission is that we have a very, very small vision of the gospel. We are all sick and sinners, and Jesus is our Savior, so he's like a pill that we take to make us feel well, or he's an insurance policy that we add in so that we don't go to eternal suffering. And the gospel is shrunk into something that is so almost minutiae, it doesn't seem to be any relevance to real life, family, economics, business, the world, history, and the outcome of the universe. But clearly it does. So, faithful presence and prophetic call. What is the call to the church? The church is called to be in the world, not of the world, and yet for the world. So we have that balance and that tension many times. How can we be in, not of, but for? And some churches do better than this. Some churches are in and not of, and therefore they build a wall, a fortress. Some believe that we are for, and they're so liberal, they're out there, that they're, but there's no gospel, and there's no holiness, and there's no clarity. So we need to get this tension. So the gospel cannot be shrunken to a privatized personal experience. It's not private just for me. It's public truth. Just like the claim Jesus is Lord is a claim about reality. Either he is or he isn't. But that has public ramifications. So we need to get beyond our own minority outlook and not feel any shame to take that publicly, which brings us then to the missionary mandate. And there are many versions, again, Matthew 28, 18 through 20, where Jesus said, "All authority in heaven and earth is given unto me. Go ye therefore and make disciples of all the nation, teaching them all that I have commanded you." John 20, 21, "As the Father sent me, so send I you." Now, John Stott calls the incarnation the model for mission. In other words, the fact that God came to earth and condescended, in John Calvin's words, to us, this is God's means of doing mission. He sends people. And you may think, well, why me? And, you know, I'm not having great talents. But it doesn't matter what you've got. It matters that you obey the one that sends you. You are who you are, and you go. And mission exists. I like this from John Piper, because worship doesn't. So the heart of missions is not just to bring people good news, the gospel, food, and build buildings and do all those kind of things. It's to bring people to worship. Because the ultimate thing is that when people obviously come back, is they discover they have a creator who loves them, a God who cares for them. And worship is the restoration, and worship is what we'll be doing in eternity. So that's what mission is about. So we want people to be restored and to find their creator, their redeemer, and their one true father. But when we get into mission over the years, one of the struggles we see sometimes is that Christians don't always drive by scripture. They sometimes drive by intentions and moods and fashion. And one of the problems I've seen today is a problem with our desire for relevance. In fact, Oz Guinness, my friend, wrote a book on this, and I want you to hear what Oz says about some of our methods in mission. He says, "By our uncritical pursuit of relevance, we've actually courted irrelevance. By our breathless chase after relevance without a matching commitment to faithfulness, we've become not only unfaithful, but irrelevant. By our determined efforts to redefine ourselves in ways that are more compelling to the modern world than are faithful to Christ, we've lost not only our identity, but our authority and our relevance. Our crying need is to be faithful as well as relevant." And so this tension is something. How do we be true to the gospel, true to scripture, true to the commands to live a holy, godly, Christ-worshipping, Christ-centered life, and be engaged? There's not one or the other. But our relevance comes like, oh, well, we have to take away crosses from our churches, and we have to stop saying certain things, and we have to use... There's sometimes a tendency where we're giving up even some of the cutting edge of what our message is. So this means for us to constantly stay on the alert and giving attention to this. So, reality, life, and truth. Dallas Willard speaks about the dominant worldview. This in Europe, certainly in the United States, in Canada, and many other Western nations, and around the world. Secularism is the reigning philosophy taught in the universities. So in the news, they assume that it's true. Most people assume there is no God, unless you're living in Saudi Arabia, in which you assume everything is God, or all is God is real anyway, or in India, in which it's more Hinduism. But here in the West, is reality secular? Is adequate knowledge secular? And is that something that's been established as a fact by thorough and unbiased inquiry? Is this something that today's secular universities thoroughly and freely discuss in a disciplined way? And the reason he's putting this here as a Christian philosopher is it's not. It's assumed. Last night you probably heard Greg Kaukel speaking and about relativism and naturalism. Well, once again, many of our universities assume that this is the basis of reality. They don't defend it. So it's our job as Christians to go on the offensive and to address it and to put this into play. So what do we see? Is reality truly secular? Well, look around just look at Europe, look at your home country. Look anywhere, look at the United States. The pull of arts and ecology and technology see that people are looking for things that are drawing their attention beyond to something higher all the time. So wonder and curiosity is a tremendous bridge for the gospel. People's natural hunger, their longing about life. Andrew Davidson said, "Apologetics should be a matter of wonder and desire, not least because reason at its most reasonable is itself a matter of wonder and desire." Have you ever thought about thinking? Maybe you take your thinking for granted, but the fact that you are thinking, you're a piece of meat thinking. I mean, that is literally true. You're a skeleton covered with meat and body tissues. But you are having rational thoughts. You're able to have pictures. You're able to do all kinds of... That is an amazing thing. You process more information than any computer. You do it faster. You have fields of vision and perception that machines cannot reproduce, no matter how big they are. You have capacities built into you that just defy the imagination. So we are creatures of incredible wonder. And so Andrew Davidson goes on, he says, it's the work of the apologist to suggest that only in God does our wonder reach its zenith, and only in God do our deepest desires find their fulfillment. The apologist may labor to show that Christian theological vision is true, but that will fall flat unless he or she has an equal confidence that it's supremely attractive and engaging. And I think this is where we run into a rub. I think there's a lot of Christians, some people who believe this without, you know, it's a self-confidence just based on their own, oh, I believe it's true because I've never asked any questions. And therefore, when they go to the university, or they may get demolished, or they may sometimes have trouble. There are others that go into the university or the public culture, and they hope it's true, but they're unsure because everything else looks bigger and more powerful. So how reliable is the gospel? How confident am I that it speaks to all of life? Because you can't give what you don't have. If you're unsure that it's true, or beautiful, or valuable, or good, then you certainly wouldn't want to share it, would you? You might, when someone whispers to you, are you a Christian? Oh, yes, yes, I'm a Christian. And would you tell me about Jesus? I'll tell you about Jesus, but I feel kind of embarrassed about it. You know, really, don't tell anybody else that I told you this. But if we're unsure, then that doubt will neutralize us, and that's why we don't have confidence. So we seek meaningful connections based in wonder, based in the truth of the gospel, based in the confidence. We look for connections. Donna Lazenby said, Christian apologists must locate what she calls diagnostic spaces, places where the relationship between religion and the wider world is being clearly played out and where this relationship can be studied. For one of my things that I've done over the years is I look a lot at books, I look at magazines, I look at films and television programs, because it's screaming all around us. The arts are a mirror into our culture. They tell us what people are thinking. It's not always very good, as we know, but it's not all very bad either. It's a mixture. There's human dramas, there's sorrow, and there's sadness, and there's anger, and there's hope, and there's fear, and there's greed, and there's sex, and all kinds of stuff. It's all out there, but it's all out there in life, so there's no surprises. The question is, what is it that people are looking for? And are there mirrors on hope? So how do we engage? How do we speak the language? How do we speak into their world? So we have to pursue serious engagement. I think communication is a serious issue, particularly, and I'm going to say this carefully, but here in Europe, because we often use, still in Europe, 20th and 19th century models that don't apply to the 21st century. Because we've kind of gone into a static mode of as if, well, we have the gospel, therefore we know all there is about reality, sometimes in our churches, and then we go out speaking, no one wants to listen, they're not interested, they don't care, they have no, and we're not looking for ways to connect with them, to provoke them. For instance, the wrong use of tradition in the world of apologetics, and you probably don't all, how many of you read apologetics? Any? Oh, you read a little bit, okay. So in the world of apologetics, there's Edward John Carnell, that was a name, was a famous textbook, still being handed out for many years. But essentially, he lived from 1919 to 1967, and it's good. It was kind of a classic. But if you're in a seminary, you're reading Carnell's book, I mean, he's really looking back to issues that were either, some of them were present, but most of them were past even at that time. So here's Alistair McGrath commenting on Carnell's work, which again is a good book, and good to read his history. Not so good to read his apologetics. Each age generates its own specific concerns and critiques of the Christian faith. Many of the issues seen as important by Carnell and the other apologists of this age now seem of little significance. Indeed, reading older works of apologetic often seems like a journey down memory lane, marked by names of writers and controversies that no longer seem relevant. Sometimes I picked that up when I was doing courses in apologetics. We'd be talking about 19th century liberalism, and some of that stuff still was relevant, but the focus and the weight was still on what it was, not what was the current incarnation. And so we needed to be up to date. Many apologists of modernity engaged their cultural context using approaches they believed would resonate with their audiences, such as an appeal to rational argument as to a basis for a trustworthy faith. As we shall see, the hallmark of good apologetics is an ability to engage specific audiences, yet the modernist assumption is the primacy of rationality has now been called into question, raising difficulties for apologetic approaches based on or appealing to it. Now, you need to hear what McGrath's not saying, that we're no longer rational or you don't use reasons and there's not a place for propositions and clarity and all of that. He's not saying that. He's saying that earlier there was a much higher incidence of reason. In the modern era, and particularly I would say up till about the late 60s, everything was reason. It was the bar of reason. There was a rationality, there was a control. But when the postmodern really began, culture began to less align to reason, look more for other types of argument. Still we use reasons, we do it in politics, we do it in life, we do it in all kinds of things, but reason was not primary anymore, and so things changed. So we need to get below the surface in our communication, and Alistair McGrath suggests, he says, the danger of forms of apologetics that respond to rationalism is that they often end up importing rationalism into Christianity, rather than exporting the gospel into the rationalist culture. And I have seen that. I have people that I know, in fact, I can think very recently, I've been at a conference and it was just like a bunch of Christian philosophers. And whilst the ideas were very rigorous and things were very good, there was missing the human component. There was missing the love of God and the grace of God and expectation of the Holy Spirit working. And because it all sounded like it was just a question, if we understand this and if we said that and if we do this and they say that, you know, it was like a game of intellectual combat. And so where is God in all that? Remember what John said the other day about trusting in our reason versus trusting in God? And that there's a danger in which that can happen even within the apologetic enterprise. It doesn't have to happen, but it can happen. So Andrew Davidson says, when most people turn to consider the substrata of thought or reality, they encounter something far more complicated and unsettling. Life is messy, isn't it? You know, you think? I mean, Freud had some truth to say, so did Nietzsche, so did Marx, so did these people. They saw something about reality. Doesn't mean that everything they said they're true by any means, but they did see some things that were true, and we need to listen to them. So we have to, as a Christian, know that life and people and emotions and hearts are very dark and complicated things. So how do we as Christian communicators, how do we probe, how do we get people stirred up? One of my heroes in history is this Socrates. You know Socrates, little Socrates going about being the gadfly and claimed to know nothing, or at least to be the least intelligent man in Athens, but the one thing he could do was ask questions. So one of the ways he wanted to ask questions was to go up to all the intelligent men and ask them questions. And by questioning all the intelligent men, he found out they weren't so intelligent because they didn't know what they thought they knew. But he just wanted them to persuade him. So tell me, and he would ask good questions. And that's the role of the Christian. And this can be fun. You know, you could be with people who are so certain that, you know, there's no resurrection, so certain that there's no Jesus, so certain that the problem of evil wipes out Christianity, so certain that you're anti-gay, so certain of all these things. And you could, well, how do you know that? Can you tell me? Why are you so angry? Have you ever looked at any of the evidences? Have you ever read about it? The Bible's full of contradictions. Could you just give me two or three of them, please? Oops. Conversation shifts surely very quickly. So then we can get down to the real reasons. We're not talking about we're talking about a prejudice. We're talking about a bias. We're not talking about reasons. So it may be, Davidson says, the task of apologetics to make the world more of a problem or a puzzle rather than less so. Before anyone can accept God as the answer to the world's questions, he or she must perceive the world to be a question. I remember a number of years ago, I was watching a group here who were well known in Europe for doing evangelism. Anyway, I was walking around the edges, and the guy was, you know, doing this thing and sharing and very passionate. Jesus is the answer. Jesus is the answer. And there were some international tourists hanging around again, and some guy says, he's going, Jesus is the answer. What's the question? And I thought that was great. Here the guy was preaching Jesus was the answer, but he had no idea what the questions were. And he didn't know what it was he was answering to. So if we don't get the questions, then we can't give Jesus as the answer. And that's what we've got to work on, finding what the questions are. So we stop answering questions that no one is asking. And we start by finding the questions that they are asking or the ones they should be. So the questions are the key. The questions bring us into the territory in which we're trying to help them think about life and why we're trying to get them before we come to Christ. Now, the fundamentals remain the same. I mean, whether we're in France, in Germany, in America, wherever we are, there's basic, or you go to any culture in the world, there's three things you have to do, and you understand this. The first is understand the gospel yourself. What is the gospel I preach? Not just do I believe in Jesus, he's the Son of God, but really think this through. If I'm going to be telling this person this is the gospel, what do you mean by that? I have to think it through well enough that I can prepare, I can give an answer to why, because they're going to come back with questions. But secondly, understand the context within which you're in. If you're in a university, you know you're going to get a set of questions very differently. If you're in a literature department, you're going to get one thing. If you're in a science department, you're going to get something else. If you're in a high school, you're going to get kids with everything. if you're in a family, if you're with Muslim friends, with your Hindus. So who's the context? Who am I talking to? Thirdly, develop apologetic approaches that are faithful to the gospel and build on the common good or points of contact with the cultural context. So I'm always looking for something. They've just said something to me where they've given me something about reality. I remember getting on a plane once with a lady who clearly was, I had just come back from a long trip. I was flying in from Asia, landed in California, was flying to Atlanta. I was tired. And it was one of those trips where a lot of ministers or speakers do the same thing. You just want to get a book and hide. So you're hoping that no one will talk to you, but you know that there's these divine appointments and God doesn't often let you off the hook. So I'm sitting there and I'm in one of these moments. So I'm just going to read my book and it's a sociology book. So I'm quite, intense. And this woman comes in, she's on her cell phone, she bumps into me and bangs, and she's putting her phone up and she's hit me about four times with her bang. I get hit about three or four times, so I'm not feeling particularly warm or friendly, So she finally squeezes in all the time on her phone, and she's all made up to the heavens and, very glam and obviously thinks she's super important, and judging by her cell phone, she was. Turns out she works in Hollywood, so she was important, she's a star. So we get down there, and I'm sitting, and finally sit down, and she spilled the drink over me on that top of it. So she saw the look, so she says, "What are you reading?" And I said to her, whatever it was, she said, "Really? Actually, that's very interesting. Why would you read that?" I says, "Well, I'm interested in the world of ice." And then she's back on the phone, so that was it. So then as we're taking off and she gets settled in, we get talking a little bit. And then, of course, when I say talking, she's telling me what she does. She's in Hollywood and she works with the film industry and she works with the art stuff, the pre-film, advertising, the PR stuff. So she's very taken with all this. And she works with somebody, Saul, and she did have some of the big movies. I knew the one. She showed me her portfolio, so it was really quite impressive. Well, then came the fun bit. "So what do you do?" I said, "Well, actually, I'm an international speaker, or at least I work with a Christian organization." And it was like, just a spat in her face or something, So she immediately launches into all the tirades about Christians imposing their agenda on people and how, George Bush was the supreme evil and the Catholic Pope controlling people's morality. And, she had a list of all this kind of thing. So we got going and I just let her go the tire and I sat there and I said, "What you're saying to me is you're a missionary." And she said, "I most certainly am not." I said, "Yes, you are." She says, "No, I'm not." I said, "Well, you've just said that you basically are out to convert. You think the Pope should be changed. You think George Bush should be taken out of the White House and his morality removed. So you're a missionary for some kind of other morality. So tell me about it." "Oh, I don't want to talk about this," she said. Okay, so we went silent. So about 5 minutes later, boom, 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 she's back. Well, this went back and forward to Atlanta for about 5 or 6 hours. Now, it wasn't like I was out there this is a story of leading her to conversion. But here's what came out. She had been raised in the Carolinas. She had been from a Christian-y kind of background. She had gone to Hollywood to be saved from what? Christianity. So she had run away from the whole Christian thing. She was angry at Christians. But she didn't really understand what it was about. And we did get into moments where we discussed the gospel. We did talk about the difference between what the gospel and life. We talked about Jesus. I gave her my testimony, so I was from a different world. And I didn't, obviously not from an American Baptist or whatever situation, so I was able to tell her very honestly. So it went very well. We went back and forward. And then as we're getting up, she pats me on the shoulder. She says, "I've got to say," she says, "you're one of the most unusual Christians I've met." So I don't know if that was a compliment or a problem or whatever, but that's where we left it. But I think if we can see ourselves as provocateurs, we may be just at least turning a hinge somewhere to get them thinking again. And I think that's our job. So Christian insights on life. The highly secular public square in a season when the media is dominated by certain interests, we may lose our sense of the valid insights that Christianity comes. So one of the things to do is do some reading on sociology, and particularly the works of people like Rodney Stark and Peter Berger. Stark has written about the history of Christianity, shows how Christianity was the basis by which universities were established, hospitals, and this is factual. I mean, it's not made up. It's not like here's a little bit of stealing of history. It's the factual basis, Berger shows, of the Christian influence, and it's good to have some of this in your fingertips because people will be talking to you thinking that Christians destroy culture, don't build it. So Christianity is a show-and-tell faith. Wasn't that in Acts chapter 1-4? It records to us all that Jesus began to do and to teach. So we have to be able to show all the things that have happened, or some of them at least that have happened in Christian life. And that's good to know about the foundation, as I said, of not only universities but policies. People like William Wilberforce. I hear people that talk about justice issues. Oh, you're interested in justice. Did you ever hear about how slavery came to an end? Oh, yes, there was an uprising. Yeah, where did it start? Did you know that it was evangelical Christians that pioneered the movement? You know that it was Christians that rallied the cause? Even Josiah Wedgwood and all these people were co-opted by the Clapham sect to make the, you know, I am not a man, the praying famous little picture. And Wilberforce, am I not a man, rather? Wilberforce, of course, lobbying for year after year after year in the British Parliament to bring down slavery. He fought the British Empire. That's no small thing. As an evangelical, he believed in justice. And we have a tradition this way. A lot of the social legislation that was born in Europe, a lot of the thing to protect workers, a lot of the 40-hour week was born of Christians. It was Christian activity, Christian labor movements to try and protect workers from exploitation and destruction. So things like this that help us to understand what Christians have done. Many people don't understand that the European Union was based on Franco-German reconciliation by Christians who wanted to stop Germany and France falling into war again and bringing the whole continent into disaster. So how did they solve that? With a covenant. What kind of covenant? The European Coal and Steel Treaty, which became the basis of the European Union many years later. Interesting ideas that are under the ground there, but can be used in our apologetic. So, lessons on life and ways of seeing. Our experiences as modern people particularly often alienate us from reality. We objectify things and we have blinkers when it comes to reality. So we miss a lot of things, especially things that make life really life. The good things. And one of the things that Christianity does is that if it's true, and if we have been born again of the Spirit, and I certainly believe I have, and I'm quite sure you have, I see things now I didn't see before. I sense things. I mean, I have this, my spirit has been obviously made alive by Christ. I'm in touch with the unseen world. And I mean, I very much live in this world, but poetry and music and arts and other things have a resonance that they didn't have before. People, I care for them now. I didn't care for them in the past. Things matter that didn't matter before. So what does Christianity do? Here's what Alistair McGrath says, writing about C.S. Lewis. He said, for Lewis, the Christian faith offers us a means of seeing things properly, as they really are, despite their outward appearance. And that meant not only human beings, but seeing the nature of things like love and hope and justice. What are these things? In my early days of going witnessing, I remember I was going around door to door in Scotland, and there was this one lady, and she would always invite me in for tea. She was a real interesting character. Her name was Ella. And of course, I'm just young in the faith, so I'm all bubbly. I've got Bible verses everywhere, and I'm, you know, just pouring out, you know, believe in Jesus, and here's the blood, and reading passages. And she'd say, oh, I just can't see it. I just can't see it. She kept saying, I just can't see it. And I was getting so frustrated because I thought, look, I'm telling her, it's real. It really is real. So I was speaking faster and louder. It wasn't persuading her. But then I noticed something about Ella. She was very, very nosy. You know, she was one of these kind of people. She knew everybody's business. She was one of the people who liked to look in everybody's. And right next door was this one house. And the neighbors always came in. The blinds were down and the door were closed. And there had been a lot of new furniture and stuff going in. And in our prior conversation, she kept talking about this house and wondered what was going on over there. And, you know, she says they had another delivery last week. And, you know, there's another thing. I think they're getting a new bathroom. And I think they're getting a new suite. And I think they're getting. And all obviously it was bothering her. And I said, suddenly dawned on me. I said, Ella, how do you know it's in there? She says, well, you know, things have been coming and going. I said, but how do you know? She says, well, I'm pretty sure there's something. I said, but you said you haven't seen it. She says, no, but I can't see it. I said, well, how would you see it? She says, well, I'd have to get in the house. I says, and how would you get in the house? I said, you'd probably have to go over and knock the door and they'd have to invite you in. But you could be standing out and they say, look, they could be saying, look, we've got furniture, we've got all this stuff. And you could be saying, I just can't see it, I just can't see it. But if they said, come in, then you'd have to step in to see. And I said, that's the same in Christian. That's what Jesus says, come in. Nicodemus came up to the house. He couldn't see either. Jesus said, you have to enter the kingdom of God. You have to see some things from the inside. Step across the line. So seeing and helping people to see. Lewis' commendation of the Christian faith, said McGrath, rests partly in his belief that it offers a capacious and deeply satisfying vision of reality, a way of looking at things that simultaneously allows both discernment of its complexity and affirmation of its interconnectedness. The human imagination plays a leading role in grasping this big picture, in that it's more easily perceived than understood. Here is what we might call a religious imaginary. I like words, by the way. Don't you like that? A religious imaginary. That's really, really cool. A way of living, seeing, and making, grounded in the Christian vision of reality, which lends coherence to the whole picture of existence. So for Lewis over time, and he was a deeply well-read literary man, he was a professor in the university, but he saw that Christianity connected things. It had a beautiful coherence to it. And so this is one of the things I think people, Richard Dawkins and the New Atheists and all these people, they think that being a Christian shrinks life. They think it makes you live a very small, boring, uninteresting. And there are boring, uninteresting Christians, so we can concede that. But it's not the gospel. The gospel is about vitality. It's about goodness and hope and justice and truth. And we need to paint that picture. But lest you get concerned that I'm leaving God out of this, and I hope I'm not, listen to Leslie Newbegin when we talk about how we don't just basically make plans and go out there. I mean, obviously we're trusting in the Holy Spirit. God's sovereignty, says Leslie Newbegin, is that of God's grace. It is as Savior that God is Lord. It is as the one who overcomes our alienation from the truth that God reveals the truth. So we know that it begins by grace, that is the work of the Holy Spirit. This is why I find this incredibly helpful to me. My job is to witness, not to convert. There's no pressure. So I can go into situations, I can ask questions, I can deal with people. I need to trust in God for grace, for kindness in my own heart. People get ugly, and they do sometimes. But, you know, Lord, just give me grace. I'm not out. And I can say to them, look, I'm not out here to convert you. I'd love it if you became a Christian. But I'm going to tell you about Jesus. You don't have to believe. I wish you would. But that's your choice. You're free. God gives you that freedom. So Newbegin says, the revelation of God is given to us in him is not a matter of coercive demonstration, but of grace, of a love that forgives and invites. That reality of grace governs both the confidence we have in speaking of God and the manner in which we must commend the gospel to others. So we are both to give grace and also to be gracious. So that's one of the keys, isn't it? How we treat people, the way we come across, how we get into their worlds, how we show what Christ is like. So, still with me? A few more minutes. Reflective missiology. We must learn the language, said Lewis, of our audience. And let me say at the outset that it's no use at all laying down a priori what the plain man does or does not understand. You have to find out by experience. This is so important. Because for many people, not for all, but if you're raised in a Christian environment, you're often raised in a church setting where you only spend your life with Christians. So you've only been around Christians, you've only talked to Christians. I mean, you go to work, you go that, but you come back into church, you go to church meetings. And so we sometimes learn, we've not learned the ability to talk about normal things, about the news or about things that are on, and we have a Christianese vocabulary. So we have to learn how people think and not be offended by their thinking. I mean, if they're talking about their sports and their money and whatever, and their parties and all these kind of things, which they will be, then we mustn't be offended. That's what they do. But how do we learn their language? And how do we, and I don't mean we endorse everything that we hear, but I mean we engage with them. So we live with eyes wide open. And particularly with our cultures, looking around us for cultural signs, for little things that will be hints. George Peters, who teaches at Dallas Theological Seminary, says, culture is a stern reality. It's as extensive as man and as comprehensive as his ways, his thoughts, his sentiments, and his relationships. It's the all-encompassing non-biological atmosphere of his being, as well as the institutions that make life tolerable and mold him into the being that he actually is. So a big part of being a Christian is doing homework. We're reading all the time, listening, thinking. Boy, things on the news, and not to use them in a utilitarian sense, but the fact is they're going to come up. I mean, if you're listening to the daily news, of course, the 24-hour cable's a problem now. It comes so fast and furious. But if you're in a locality, there are things that happen here in Viswa or in Tiche or Pristina or around us that you would be aware of that are news, or in our part, people, kids getting shot in school or events happening nationally. And everybody wants to talk about, why is that happening? And what, is the country out of control? What, kids aren't being trained anymore? Or who's to blame? Were the police not there fast enough? Well, everybody wants to blame someone, but it raises big questions about the human heart. We listen, we watch. Big movies that come out, people get in a buzz. Just think of when Tolkien was, or the Lord of the Rings was doing the rounds. Everybody was a Tolkien fan for a while. And we're talking about dragons and elves and Mordor and two towers uniting and all kinds of wonderful stuff and knights and good versus evil and kings coming back. There's a lot of stuff you can talk about the gospel in there. So we use that as bridges. But it means we have to, what makes people happy? What makes them sad? What brings them joy? Why? That's the question that Paul looked at when he was going through Acts. That which you worship in ignorance, how could he come there? Because he had looked to see what the thing meant. You heard John say this over and over again. When we look at symbols, when we look at music, when we look at ideas, we need to ask, what does it mean to them, not to you? What I heard from Christians, well, that's demonic or that's this. It may well be demonic. That's not the point. What does it mean to them? They don't think it's demonic. They think it's a source of life. They think it's a source of happiness. It gives them pleasure or joy or hope or something. So rather than seeing them, people going into a temple or offering, this is when you're in India sometimes and you see people streaming into temples and doing pujas and lighting candles. Well, yes, they're offering, but they're offering because they're looking for answers. They're wanting peace. They don't want the universe to attack them. And so this is their way of assuaging it. So find out why. So each audience is different, and we know that. I mean, you're different from the people that we were speaking to earlier, and that's fine. You're very nice and very quiet. Thank you. But when we're addressing audiences, when you're talking to people, there are several things to try and understand. When you're communicating, you're thinking, whether you're planning this, whether it's in your regular business, whether it's in your work, whether it's in wherever you're going, three things we should always keep in mind to address the specific audience. When you look at the New Testament, you think of Paul used a very different strategy when he was talking to Jews, when he was talking to Greeks, and when he was talking to Romans. So who is the specific, and what do we need to know about them? But secondly, and this is probably the bit that we miss out a little bit, identify the authorities that carry weight with that audience. So who are they? I mean, these days, this is with young people, it's a lot to do with their music. They're tribal, defined by different music tribes, right? So we're listening to different music and television. So who are the authorities? Who do they lean on? Who do they quote? I was recently in a university in Pittsburgh, and the professor of philosophy claimed to be a humanist, but it seemed to me, and he was a very serious man, he was a good man, he was an interesting man, but he hated Christians and he hated Christianity, and he made that quite clear. And I thought that was kind of interesting. How could you be a humanist claiming to love humans, but you don't love Christians? So there seemed to be a missing piece in his... So I was quoting Camus and Habermas and some other people that he seemed to like, but he seemed to ignore certain parts of their writings. But he said at one point, my son pointed this out, I thought it was quite funny, he said that he got really exasperated, we were having a bit of fun, I was joking and teasing him, and he said, this is interesting, he said, I'm the professor of philosophy, he says, he's out-quoted me 10 to 1 on Philosophers Tonight, and he said, they're all philosophers that I like. I thought it was quite nice. So at least I had quoted authorities, even if he didn't accept what I was saying, he liked the authorities that I was bringing before him. So use lines of argument that will carry weight with the audience. I was in San Marcos University in Peru recently, and it was a very strong Marxist university at one time. And so to do the message, we had one of my friends who's a converted Shia Muslim, he's 6'8", he's a marvelous man, Abdul Murray, and he presented on the basis of law has to be rooted in transcendence, otherwise law has no moral authority. So here we are, they wanted to talk about law and justice, so use the lawyer to talk about law and justice. But of course, as a lawyer, speaking about law and justice, he knows you can't have law and justice unless it's transcendently anchored. And so he gave it, and then we opened it up for Q&A, and we got lots of questions and lots of interaction. Very good on that subject, because they're not used to hearing that. For them, there is no transcendence. Law is an instrument of establishing the power of the state. So we could get into some pretty big discussions. It was good fun. So the role of experiment and risks. I think we have to try to break out and do different kinds of things. A lot of people are afraid. They're afraid of being beaten down. They're being afraid of coming up against big guns, and Christians as much as everything. One of the things I think is a great way is if you can find people who are real serious opponents, Muslims, Hindus, or atheists, and say, look, rather than having a debate, would you, in the university or somewhere else, would you be willing to do something? And this is what we did in Oklahoma State University. We called it perspectives. So we'll take one topic. What does it mean to be human? Is there such a thing as goodness? And you tell us, as an atheist, what does it mean to be human or what goodness is? And you can do any, you can explain, you get 15 minutes. We as Christians, we'll talk about what we believe goodness is. And then the audience will be the referees. They ask us questions. And we'll just take it from there. And there'll be a moderator to keep us on time. And we can be asked for clarity questions. And this was good fun. The atheist guys had billboards all around. They said the 7th biggest atheist group in the States. And said, God is dead, stay home, don't go to church on Sunday, this kind of thing. And so a Christian approached them and challenged them, would they be willing to do that? And so they were willing, but then when we talked to them, we were kind of afraid to do it publicly. So we established these rules. But what happened was during the communication, the atheist society and the people then started talking to each other afterwards. Now, again, I don't know where all that will lead. We'll see. But conversations began. How else can we get the ball out there? Faith is not certainty, by the way. Faith involves risk. So, three things, and then we're done. How do we go forward? David Clark, who is a son of a missionary and also a Christian philosopher, said this in a fabulous book called Dialogical Apologetics. He says, to get at what is said and why it is said, good listening examines how it is said. By attending carefully, an apologist tries to get inside the other person's perspective. This includes listening for and noting intellectual commitments, attitudes, and feelings. A careful listener discerns the other's cultural identity and self-concept as well. She hears both the conceptual content of words and their emotional feeling. And that's so important that when you're communicating with anybody that you're watching the emotional temperature, because it can get pretty heated unnecessarily. And if someone gets mad, you can just dial it down. Hey, I'm not here to make you angry. Now, with due respect to my Scottish buddy who was on stage last night, I have certain reservations with us giving this belligerent approach. I think when there's belligerent atheists, we should go after it and we should talk to it. But provoking people to anger only stirs up unnecessary emotions. What we need to do is learn to bring the emotions down and talk seriously. Say, look, if you want to talk, let's talk. You want to give reasons, let's give reasons. But we don't need to have combat. In combat, you seek to vanquish your opponent. In evangelism, you seek to win them. Christianity is not about vanquishing people. We're about winning them to Christ. So, do we have ways and means deployed to the right end? One of the things I think that's needed in individual lives and in churches is to develop research and development departments. It's interesting in industry, and you're a businessman, so you would get this. Businesses function, as do the military, with staying alert of what's going on. You need to stay in research. You need new technology. You need to find out what your enemies are or potential enemies do. What have they? What kind of equipment do they have? Is it good equipment? Is it bigger, better, faster than yours? If you don't stay up on it, war comes, you're in trouble. Same in business, if you don't stay ahead. Why is it in churches we have no research and development? Why don't we, as you know, building to ask questions about what's going on in culture? What are the ideas? What's capturing people? What are the tools that we can give to help people be reconciled? Are we being effective? So I would say this is a key thing for us, for any church, to get at least three or four people whose job is research the culture, help us, so that we can adapt then some of our biblical exegesis, some of our training, some of our discipleship to meet the needs that research develops. The Lordship of Christ. You'll know in 1 Peter chapter 3, he says, set apart in your heart Jesus Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give reasons for the hope that you have, but to do this with gentleness and reverence. So our goal is to live in the Lordship of Christ, and to see God intervene. So Graham Ward puts it this way, apologetics viewed in this way assists the gospel in setting people free from false desires, assumed needs, bewitching ideas, unreflected habits, and substitutions for the real objects of their longing. To worship God and recognize the true orientation of the human heart towards such worship. He says elsewhere, apologetics spearheads evangelism, and it begins with reading the signs of the times. So we are in the business of seeing people set free. And I can't do that, you can't do that, but you can be an instrument by which God brings you into divine appointments with people. He helps you to think of questions and gives you resources that draws them to make connectors. So this is, I think, can be fun. Doesn't need to be boring, doesn't need to be scary. It can be that at times as well, but you know, it's something that we can do with gusto. So what is the proper confidence? Where do we look? I want to just close with a couple of verses, and then if you want a few moments of question or answer as you wish, I'm happy to oblige. But I love these passages, and this has meant a lot to me in the last number of years, because there's a sense in which sometimes even as Christians we undermine Jesus. You know, I've seen a kind of apologetics that is all about something else. It's about truth, it's about ideas, it's about science, and I believe in truth and ideas and science, by the way. But the central message that we're here about is about Jesus, right? And so we need to, how do we keep that front and center? And Paul writing to the Corinthians, where he was being said, look, implied that his rhetoric wasn't, you know, polished enough, and his ideas were a little bit, you know, he wasn't really coming across with pizzazz, if you like. He says this, "For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved it's the power of God. For it's written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside." Now, if you know the background to this passage, you'll know that Paul goes on to give a very sophisticated rhetorical argument. So apparently he was not throwing rhetoric out of the... but he's not putting his trust there. So what did he put his trust in? Well, he says in chapter 2, 1 and 2, "When I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. I determined to know nothing amongst you except Jesus Christ and him crucified." And I think that's where our hope lies. If we go out there and he's not with us, if he's not real, if he's not risen from the dead, then we have nothing to share and nothing to do, and we'll certainly never see anything happen. So we're just feeling some moral obligation to be religious or to try and push our philosophy, which I don't feel. I believe that he is real, he is risen. And so the confidence that comes from that, Leslie Newbegin sums it up this way. "The confidence proper to a Christian is not the confidence of one who claims possession of a demonstrable and indubitable knowledge. It's the confidence of one who has heard and answered the call that comes from the God through whom and for whom all things are made. Follow me." So when we go out there, we invite people and said, you know, Christ is real. You can know him, you can follow him, but you have to taste and see. And that's what we leave. And that's where the risk lies. And that is the challenge for us and for them. God bless. So you want a couple of minutes and then we can run and get coffee or just run, period? Any comments or... So the comment was made that the lady is involved in music, particularly in orchestra, also in writing music and using music as a vehicle, as another language, and of communicating the gospel. And I think you're absolutely right, particularly in this generation, or just because people's spirits are so crushed, art and beauty connects us to reality, to transcendence. So I think the sense of coherence and symphony, and that is a marvelous way. And I think that today this is what we need to get back to, using, again, that's part of the show and tell. These kind of things are going to lead to, when people start thinking about it, you know, when you ask people something like, okay, what is music? Why does it, you know, you're hearing something. What's hearing? What are you hearing? Where is it? Yes, give us Bach and the cantatas. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's in Matthew's Passion. Good. I just commend you into God's hand, and may his will be done through us all wherever we're found. God bless you.